This podcast is brought to you by Viva Global. Experience the difference with Viva. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
The J Talk Podcast. Yes, 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 yes.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk podcast. I'm Ben Maxwell. On this week's episode, Sam Robson from Football Radar is our guide for a full review of J1 Match Day 6, while we'll also be joined by Dan Orlowitz after an impressive come-from-behind win for FC Tokyo on Saturday. And then later on, Stuart Smith returns for a look at J2 Match Day 8 and the last three rounds in the second tier. The J-Talk podcast starts now. After another action-packed J1 match day, Sam Robson is back to round it all up. Sam, welcome back to J-Talk. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm great. And joining us from the start of the show, direct from the offices of the Japan Times, is Dan Orlowitz. Dan, welcome back to the pod. How are things?
Things are great. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. Always a pleasure to have you both on. It was quite a pleasurable afternoon at the end of the day, wasn't it, Dan, for FC Tokyo at Ajinomoto Stadium on a lovely Saturday afternoon. You were there and, they certainly didn't have it all their own way, but they stayed unbeaten on the season and, ended up claiming all 3 points. So a nice day out.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was obviously a win is a great result on any day. And for Tokyo especially if you look at last season's home game against S-Pulse and how they sort of threw that away. I think that was in the rain, if I recall correctly. But Saturday was just blue sky and great atmosphere, even though the attendance was a bit lower than I expected. And S-Pulse looked pretty strong in the first half. They scored that goal, Koi Kitagawa, early in the second. Chong Tese had a couple great chances to score, about two or three opportunities that he just couldn't get in, struck the crossbar once. I think if he had scored that opportunity early, we might be talking about a different result. But then Kenta Hasegawa, FC Tokyo's manager, just made some great substitutions, and Jael and Na Sang-ho came on and just absolutely changed the pace of the game.
Yeah, they were two really important moves, weren't they, from Hasegawa? Yeah, at the same time with about half an hour to go. Sam, the last time you were on was with Alex Bishop, and after years and years of me trying to avoid talking about FC Tokyo, all of a sudden, I can't help myself. So, you're back on with another one of our FC Tokyo-centric guests. So, I guess I'm just trying to enjoy this while it lasts, because, there were definitely signs in the Shimizu game that, there's certainly cracks in the armoury of FC Tokyo. But at the end of the day, as we've said, they have emerged unscathed and they've kept their unbeaten record intact. And to tack another 3 points on to their tally this early was a pleasing result for Dan and myself.
Yeah, another really good result, and especially against a team that performed quite well. Shimizu are a lot better, I think, than bottom of the league would suggest, and they gave Tokyo a really good game. But it shows that Tokyo can match up against a difficult opponent, make a couple of changes, as Dan mentioned, and then come away with a victory even so. I agree completely with Dan. The changes were absolutely key to this. And it's kind of it shows a bit of an increase in squad depth from last season, where Tokyo again had that set 11, but then the options off the bench weren't really going to change a game at all. And he didn't really use much outside of a first 11, maybe first 13. But with the likes of Jael to come in and Na Sang-ho, there's definitely good options there. And still a few areas, as you say, that are of concern. I think you can be got at defensively. And then in midfield, as I think I mentioned last time, if you lose Takahashi or Hashimoto, there's not a lot to come into that midfield otherwise. But maybe if you can get to the same sort of position as you were last season when you get towards the summer, maybe a couple of key signings in that summer window that might be able to keep your momentum going. But, I mean, it's another very good start to the season for Tokyo.
Most definitely. And, Dan, I mean, yeah, we're going to come on to talk about the run of home games that Tokyo is going to have in the first half of the season. And they really do need to make hay while they can at Ajinomoto Stadium, don't they? So, yeah, as we've said, to tack on another 3 points is very important here. But, yeah, as we've said, they didn't have it all their own way. And, yeah, Chong Tesei hit the post in the first half. And then, yeah, 2 minutes after the break, Koya Kitagawa with a lovely header over, arcing over Akihiro Hayashi. He seemed to catch the ball while it was still on the way up. The ball in from Renato Augusto timed his jump perfectly. And, yeah, 2 minutes after the break, it was a bit of a sucker punch, I felt, because, obviously, yeah, Shimizu had that great chance through Chong Tesei in the first half. But for Tokyo, there was a lot of huffing and puffing, but the final ball was lacking pretty much all the way through, wasn't it? Until, as we've said, those two changes on the hour really turned it around.
Yeah, they threatened really early to begin with, and then once Shimizu found their footing, they were able to take it back and not necessarily have a sustained attack, but, you know, create those chances deep in Tokyo's area. And Tokyo have been going for this more sort of punchy counterattack style, and we saw that with the ball getting played out to Nagai on the right wing, with obviously Diego Oliveira as sort of the big target this season. And what we saw last season, which was my concern once they went down on Saturday, was that once Oliveira is sort of neutralized as a target, what's your B plan? And that's a question that they didn't have an answer to in the second half of last season. But now it seems like they might, because I think once Jael came on, he and Oliveira, obviously, you know, the two Brazilians can communicate very well with each other on the pitch. They gave Takefusa Kubo some options, especially with now Sung Ho on, and that's what we saw in those two goals. That cross from Oliveira to equalize, I forget exactly which minute it was, but it was just a great play, and it shows that he can not only score, but if you can assist, that's just as important. And it was a great confidence maker for Sung Ho. I mean, it's his first season in Japan, K2 MVP last year, K2 top scorer last year. And I think that he and Jael both have so much potential. And so for them to both be so involved in Saturday was immense. And it did a lot for their confidence, and you saw that with them talking to reporters after the game.
Yeah, terrific stuff. So, Sam, what did you see especially from Na Sung Ho on Saturday? For me, you know, he obviously came on with Kensuke Nagai getting the hook, and perhaps I'm too critical of Nagai at times. I mean, often to me seems like he's just running around like a chicken with his head cut off. I mean, he's obviously very good at harrying defenders when they try and play the ball out of defence, but we all know his deficiencies as a finisher. He's certainly far from the most clinical Japanese striker going around. But from Na Sung Ho, and obviously Tokyo were chasing the game, so he had to be front foot as soon as he came on. But he seemed to be very comfortable exchanging positions with Diego Oliveira and Jael. He was happy to go central, even though that's where you would expect the two Brazilians to be, occupying space. And as Dan said, Oliveira was prepared to peel off and out to the left to deliver the cross. And, yeah, Na Sung Ho's arrived in perfect timing to poke the ball home before Yuji Rokutan could get out to it.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think kind of like he's got the same sort of energy as Nagai. He's got the pace as well, but he's kind of a bit cleverer with his movement, I found. As you said, Nagai can often just kind of run himself into a cul-de-sac, or if he is on goal, you don't really want to put your house on him. But he looks a lot more clinical. He will have had a lot of confidence from the goals he scored at a lower level last year, but still getting goals under your belt has got to be a confidence booster. And I just thought, yeah, his link-up play was really good. He was full of energy, like, always wanted the ball, never shy of getting on into possession. And yeah, I was really impressed. It's one of the first times I've really got to see a lot of him. He's had a couple of cameo appearances. He's been booted by Tatsuki Nara, but otherwise, I've not seen too much of him, but I was really impressed. And that kind of front four that ended the game with Narc and Kubo kind of working alongside the two Brazilians, Diego and Jael, that had the makings of a really exciting front four. So I don't know if they might go towards that in the next couple of games, but it's definitely very good options.
Absolutely superb. And Dan, you mentioned the Brazilian hotline that Diego Oliveira and Jael might be establishing. Well, we saw it in full effect with the 4 minutes to go as Tokyo claimed all 3 points after Oliveira's third goal of the season. A brilliant 1-2. The ball was played into Oliveira. He flicked it out to nonchalantly with the outside of his right boot. And Jael swiveled and played a lovely dink ball over the top to Oliveira, who in turn dinked the ball over Rokutan. And just under the bar in real time, I thought, oh, God, he hasn't hit the bar, has he? And it was going to bounce out. But he's placed it absolutely perfectly. And, Na Sung Ho is still finding his feet in the J-League. Jael is still getting up to fitness. But, if those two can click, the two Brazilians, then, we might be in for a decent season after all.
I asked Jael after the game in the mix zone, just sort of what his thoughts were on whether or not this was the performance that would get him a spot in the starting lineup. And he said that he's had three appearances, and I guess really if you discount the 1 minute cameo against Nagoya, only two real meaningful appearances. But in that span, I mean, one goal, one assist. And he was pretty satisfied with that production. And he says that whether or not he's a starter or if he's on the bench, he's just ready to contribute, which I thought, it was a bit of an obvious thing to say, but also mature. He's obviously, he's come all the way from Brazil. He wants to start. He wants to play 90 minutes. He wants to make that impact. But for now, he's just working on getting into the system and doing what he can to help. And that was just a tremendous pass to Diego. And if he keeps doing that, nobody will be complaining. I did want to point out with Kubo, I guess, really, as he continues to perform, and he did hit the bar twice, we're pretty sure. Twice, three times, something like that.
Well, after the first goal, he shot, I think, narrowly wide of the bar. He might have flicked it on the way past, but he came very close to making it 2-1 almost straight after Nasongo's goal. But then, yes, he definitely did hit the post later on after a terrific dribble through the middle of the park.
Yeah, I mean, the question, I think we talk about Kubo being such an important part of the squad, and he has turned out to be an important part of the squad. The question is, how long are Tokyo going to have him? I read a column in, I believe it was a Web Sportiva, sometime last week, and the theory was basically what this writer said was, if Kubo stays with Tokyo the whole season, they can win the title. That's not necessarily a thesis I disagree with. The question is, will he actually stay with Tokyo the whole season? I think now it's always going to be in the back of our mind. If Kubo leaves, is he irreplaceable? Or, who can step up in his place?
Well, I mean, if that was to be the case, then that's come around in six games, Dan, because, as you know, he didn't feature at all for the first team before this season. So if Tokyo's title hopes were going to be scuppered because a 17-year-old kid had left the club halfway through the season, then I would suggest that their title chances weren't all that realistic to begin with. But he does deserve a lot of credit, and so does Hasegawa for sticking him in at the start and sticking with him. The Reds game was the first one that he hadn't started all season, and that's because he was on under-22 duty. So he has been extremely effective so far, and it's absolutely brilliant to see, because I wasn't sure he was ever going to reach this level with Tokyo before he left again. So to see him so effective so early on is terrific. And, he's obviously already made his mind up. So at the moment, it's not affecting him. And so we'll wait and see. And whether there'll be any clarity before there's a sudden announcement from the club, well, I guess there'll just be hearsay and gossip for the time being. But, it's terrific to see the impact he's had early on. Dan, I'll come straight back to you because I mentioned last week that Barry Valder was flying into the country to try and rescue the good ship Espolz. They've obviously struggled mightily at the start of the season. I have it on good authority that you met up with Barry on Saturday. Is he in good spirits? And most importantly, is he sticking around for the derby next weekend, do you know?
He was in good spirits at halftime when we met. I don't know if he was in good spirits after the game. I don't know if he's going to stick around for the derby on, is that Saturday, question mark? Probably on Saturday. Yeah, I'm not sure. I hope he did mention that he was sticking around for another week, so I imagine that he'll catch that and head back. But no, he was looking good. I think it was the first time that we had seen each other in about a decade. So time really does fly if you think about how long we've all been making the same complaints about the same teams.
Good Lord. And yeah, I mean, Sam said that he thinks, yeah, Shimmies are in a false position. And yeah, obviously they were 15 minutes away from winning this game and 5 minutes away from a point on the road. And probably the most important thing to come out of this game from an Espolz perspective, Dan, was the return of Douglas. He came on for a bit of a cameo towards the end and, yeah, obviously didn't look out of place. It'll take him some time to obviously get his match fitness back. But for all the Espolz supporters, it would have been a massive boost to see him back out on the pitch.
You talk to the players after the game, you talk to Jan Johnson after the game, nobody thinks that Espolz are on the brink yet. I think everyone said that they played well, they were disappointed with the result, as they should be. I think Johnson was more worried than anything about just the confidence impact that can happen, you know, when a team plays well and still loses. But, you know, nobody's hitting the panic button yet. I agree with Sam. I think that they can turn it around. Just a matter of time.
And, Sam, I said a cameo there, but, I mean, it was 25 minutes for Douglas. And, obviously, you're well and truly on record on this podcast about your thoughts on Douglas. You picked him out as one of the key signings in the summer transfer window last year, and you were proven correct as he stormed his way to double figures in almost as many appearances, almost a goal a game in the second half of last season. And yeah, you've mentioned a couple of times already this year how big a loss he's been so far for Espolz. So it obviously is a lot of pressure to place one player when he's coming back from such a serious medical condition. But as I've said and Dan said there, yeah, it'll be a great boost for the Shimizu squad and their supporters, of course. I mean, they won't need any motivation to get up for next weekend, of course, when they're away at Iwata. But yeah, to see Douglas back on the pitch will have, perked them up, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's one of the very few correct predictions I've got on record, so I'm going to chant about that for as long as I can. I think, yeah, the derby game is perfect, I think, for Shimizu, because as the old cliche goes, form goes out of the window in a derby match. They'd be just fully focused on beating Jubilee. They have pretty good record recently. I know there have been a couple of, like, 5-1 victories, I think, in the last couple of seasons, so they should have confidence from that. Maybe Douglas will be fit enough to start. I'm not really sure how much of a pre-season he had. But add him into the squad. His partnership with Kitagawa last season was very good. And then I just think they need to work defensively as well, because they lost Leandro Freire to Shonan over the winter, and he had a very good partnership with Hwang Seok-ho. And they've got Yugo Tatsuta in there, who's only a really young defender. And that partnership is going to take a little bit of getting used to. Plus, you've got Elsinho at right back, who, as you know, it's such an attacking fullback, so he's not really helping out enough with Tatsuta defensively. So I think they need to kind of tweak that a little bit. But then once they get Douglas back, I think they'll start clicking more as an attacking unit, and I'm pretty confident they'll be pushing up the table pretty soon.
All right, well, the only way is up for Espolz. That's for definite. They're the only team in J1 that yet to win after 6 match days. They have the leakiest defence so far with 16 goals conceded. But, yes, as Sam said, and as we all know, yes, the form book goes out the window. The Shizuoka Derby coming up this weekend is a perfect opportunity for Espolz to right their ship somewhat, or, yeah, at least begin to do so. All right, Dad, before we let you go, I'd like to move on to another one of the early games from Saturday, and that was Hiroshima hosting Gunma Osaka. I mentioned it towards the end of the podcast last week that this was going to be an important early test for Hiroshima, as Gunma, their record through five games was two wins and three losses. Their two wins had both come on the road, and their three losses had all come at home. Well, that form book went out the window as well, as Hiroshima roared into an early 2-0 lead in the first 10 minutes. And, yes, slowly but surely, I think I'm going to have to walk back my my criticism of Hiroshima. I haven't been as stringent in that regard as some other guests in the last year and a bit. But, yeah, tell you what, Dan, they've roared back to the top of the table. I was expecting Tokyo to be top, but, Hiroshima have pipped Tokyo on goal difference after, swamping Gunma with three excellent goals.
Well, it's easy to keep up that goal difference. I think this was their fifth straight clean sheet, which I forget if that's – I think that's a club record. I saw something on Twitter about that being a record of some sort. I think it was club. Surely it wasn't a league record. What impressed me most about those three goals is that – I mean, they were all fantastic goals. Those were all highlight reel goals, especially, I mean, Shibasaki's rocket – was just, phenomenal. But what impressed me most is that it all came from different players. And in fact, I think out of their seven goals have been scored by five players so far this season. And if they can keep that up, that's going to be one of the most important things going forward. It's the same, I think, when you get a team that relies on one striker to do the heavy lifting. If they're neutralized or if they're injured, then you sort of don't know what to do. So with giving confidence to, to Kashua and to Kawabe and to Shibasaki, to, for all of them to be involved in the scoring, and Douglas Vieira, who was great for Verdy last season and was probably one of the better sort of internal Brazilian signings of the offseason, if them and having, just having Patrick as the option. Like, if Patrick's your B plan and everyone else is firing on all cylinders, you've got just so many options on the attack. But they've got to keep that up. I mean, Gamba's defense didn't really look that impressive. But, we'll still have to see how Hiroshima does against stronger opposition as the season goes on. But I was very impressed with this game, and we'll see if they can keep it up. I definitely won't be surprised to see them neck and neck for the J1 title if they do decide to sort of give up on the ACL race.
Yes, indeed. I was going to mention that, they're home on Wednesday night against the Daegu of South Korea after, having beaten Melbourne Victory in their second ACL group stage game. But back to this game, Sam, on Saturday afternoon. I mean, three excellent goals. I mean, they've taken their chances extremely well, and to stun Gunma in the first 10 minutes and score two really well-taken goals. As Dan mentioned, Shibasaki's a 25-yard screamer was absolutely electric, and then that came after Gakuto Notsuda had played in Yoshifumi Kashiwa to score in just the second minute. So there was obviously a long way back for Gunma from that point, but still a long way in the game, and a lot of football still to be played. But was this a matter of Hiroshima taking their limited chances and scoring three excellent goals, or over the course of the game were they clearly the better team, and did they restrict Gunma and their opportunities to try and work their way back into it?
They definitely restricted Gunma. I think they were really clinical. They started quickly, got those two goals, and that then plays into their game plan perfectly, because they like to sit back. They're the most disciplined team in the league in terms of the shape that they get. They limit the opportunities. It's difficult for anyone to really create too many chances against them. And when you're 2-0 down inside 10 minutes, it's almost an impossible task. But, I mean, my humble pie is baking in the oven ready for me to eat later with Hiroshima. They've been very good this season. They're always going to be one of those teams that a lot of people, myself included, don't really like to watch, in terms of they're quite defensive, quite rigid. and it's not going to be the free-flowing football that you might get from, say, Yokohama or Nagoya. But this season, I think they've been helped somewhat by the two injuries to Ayama and Inagaki, because they're quite a bit more limited midfielders in that they're going to sit in front of the defence, kind of work hard, and then just recycle it quite simply. But they've had to, they've kind of been forced into playing Hayao Kawabe and youngster Taishi Matsumoto in midfield, who are naturally more expressive players, naturally want to get on the ball and create things. And I think having those two in there has allowed them to go forward with a bit more freedom, helps with the three goals they scored in this game. And as Dan said, there are more options this season than just kind of Patrick as it was last year. Once he stopped scoring goals, Hiroshima stopped scoring goals, and that's when they started to fall away. But with those two in midfield, Douglas Vieira up front, and then I've really liked Salomonson. I mean, he scored that ridiculous volley in his first game, so that's a perfect way to introduce yourself. But he gives them a great option on the right, with Kashiro on the other side. So there are a lot of good things to about Hiroshima, and I think they're more set this year to kind of maintain their consistency rather than last season.
All right, so Dan, it's a deja vu all over again with Hiroshima and FC Tokyo as the top two in J1. Last season, Tokyo rose to second in match day 9, coincidentally after a win over Shimizu. That was at Nihon Daira, with Hiroshima already, of course, bolting clear at that stage. And they remained the top two in J1 for 13 rounds before Kawasaki moved above Tokyo in match day 22 and thus commenced their relentless pursuit of Sanfrecce, who it must be said resembled a broken down antelope by the time that Kawasaki had won the league by 12 points, and Hiroshima ended up miles off the pace. But we mentioned, and I didn't come back to it before we moved off Tokyo, but this run of home games that Tokyo have pretty much most of the summer, there's a run of 8 straight away that they have to play between match day 24 and match day 31. That's, of course, due to the Rugby World Cup. So that means that they are very, very front-loaded with home games. I think there's 2 straight times where they play 3 in a row at home. And that comes in a run of 7 games in between the 2 runs of 3 at home. They play away at Espoles in the middle of July. So, yeah, I mean, there are runs of 2 home games in a row for Tokyo for most of the first half of the season. So they've really got to make the most of that and really try and make Ajinomoto a fortress and not just get draws from those games, but they've really got to try and take 3 points from as many of them as they can, don't they?
Absolutely. They need to win as many home games as they can. I think that if they can be not just second, but I think they need to be in first by about, I'm going to say, 5 or 6 points. And I'm this is on the record now, so I'll be nailed to this cross at the end of the season, I'm sure. I think if they're in first by about 5 or 6 by that last home game in August, that would be their 15th home game of the season in August, then you can say that maybe they can hold on. But I think that if you're coming into that stretch of away games in second or third, that's tough. It's just going to be tough on the club. It's going to be tough on the players, tough on the supporters. And I was actually a bit disappointed that only 22,000 came out to Saturday's game. I know sorry, Barry, I know it's only Shimizu S-Poles, but the weather was beautiful. Game was actually pretty good, and there was really no excuse. And the club has to do more to bring out fans and the active support, which as anyone on Twitter knows, I've been fairly critical of these last few years, has to do more to create an atmosphere and to create something out of that. Because once these home games are over, it's over. It's away territory the rest of the way, and that's never easy in the J League.
Yes, indeed. I don't know if they can spin it or something, like they'll become the Road Warriors or something and try and make a promotion out of the fact that they're going to be away for so many games. But, that'll be a really interesting, a really interesting sociological experiment, I suppose, to see what happens with Tokyo playing that many in a row on the road. But obviously, there's a lot of home games between now and then. And yeah, I'll actually be going along on Sunday for Kashima at home at Ajinomoto. So looking forward to that. And yeah, Dan, so it's been great to have you on again to talk about the top two in J1. As I said, deja vu once again. So yeah, thanks for your time, and yeah, look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Pleasure. Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Sam, and hope to be back soon.
All right, then. Thanks again to Dan. After a quick hit of music, Sam and I will wrap up the rest of J1 Match Day 6. All right, thanks again to Dan. That's the top two in J1 covered after Match Day 6. Let's turn the clock back, Sam, to last Friday night. We've mentioned, obviously, Hiroshima in ACL action this Wednesday. Well, the other three J1 ACL clubs hosted opponents on Friday night to give themselves an extra day of preparation before Match Day 3 of the ACL group stage. And contrasting results for the away teams, because we're starting with Urawa 0, Yokohama 3. Of the three away teams, Yokohama put in by far the most convincing performance, Sam. A blistering start for F. Marinos, with Marcos Junior scoring after just 7 minutes. But this game, and in particular Urawa's performance, was certainly not a banner evening for J-League defending, was it? Full credit to Yokohama for taking their chances, but confusion between Mauricio and Shusaku Nishikawa allowed Marcos Junior to score the first. Then, Keita Endo robbed Takuya Aoki for the second before Rikuto Hirose was completely unmarked for the third. So we'll obviously come back and talk about those three goals in more detail. But yeah, a horror show for Reds, and a lot to work on the training pitch this week, I'm sure.
Yeah, horror show is exactly right. I mean, I've seen a lot of poor defensive displays in Japan, but this is right up there. I mean, they were caught out so many times. 3-0 was like such a low score, really, compared to what Yokohama should have put up. The amount of times they got into fantastic crossing positions with men just completely unmarked in the middle and just messed up the cross or took the wrong option. I mean, 7 or 8 would not have been much of a stretch in this game. And Yokohama just, they've moved, no, not Yokohama, sorry, Urawa have moved back to this back four. And they played Moriwaki and Yamanaka as the fullbacks. But they push on so high, and there's just no cover in behind them. So many times they just play in behind those two. Then everyone would rush across and then just leave players completely unmarked. It was just shambolic defending, and no midfielders were helping out. And each of the defenders had poor games individually. Like for the first goal, it's Ryosuke Yamanaka's crossing, which then causes the confusion between his other defensive partner and the goalkeeper and concede the first goal. It was just really atrocious, and it's not like Yokohama were incredible. They played quite well, but I think they've played better this season and got worse results. And like Postecoglou will look at that and think, maybe why players need to be a bit more clinical. They did lose Edgar Jr. to a hamstring injury, which is a massive blow, given that Tadanori Lee's also are injured, and Yuki Otsu missed out of the weekend through injury as well. So there's a few issues there, but I mean, yeah, they'll take enormous positives from an absolute mauling of Urawa.
Yeah, potentially huge loss. With Edgar Junior set to miss probably around a month, you would imagine. His compatriot, as I've said, did score twice on the evening, and was the beneficiary of a couple of ordinary pieces of defending. Or in the case of the second goal, I mean, Takuya Aoki was just caught napping by Keita Endo, who he and Koji Miyoshi had seen a close-range shots blocked by Nishikawa. But then, Endo showed a terrific resolve to rob Aoki and fed Marcos Jr., who had the time and space to turn onto his left foot before curling home. And then, Rikuto Hirose, he won the battle of the left-backs on the night, Sam. It must have been bittersweet for F. Marino supporters to see Ryosuke Yamanaka turn out in the red kit, although, of course, he had only had two seasons, I think, with AF Marino, so he certainly wasn't one of their homegrown heroes, but he had become an important player for them, hadn't he, by the time he left the club at the end of last season. But then, Hirose, he was given the freedom of the entire left-hand side of the pitch, and Marcos Junior finished off his man of the match display with a very simple assist to find Hirose, who had time to pick his spot at 20 minutes from time. So, both of these sides have had a pretty, up and down, puzzling starts to the season, Sam. We've mentioned numerous times about Reds being very slow to get going after their abbreviated pre-season. So we probably don't need to spend too much time on that particular point again. But they had battled back and rescued a point at the death against FC Tokyo last week. But now, after seeing the way they performed on Friday night and hearing you describe how comfortable it was for Yokohama, I just can't help but think that was a missed opportunity that FC Tokyo have bottled at the death last week.
I think it was, actually. Urawa's, like, the way they set up, it doesn't lend well to teams that attack in the way that Yokohama did, and earlier in the season when Sapporo kind of took them to the cleaners as well. With their kind of more advanced fullbacks and whatnot, they're under less pressure against a team like Tokyo that's going to sit back and counter. Mm-hmm. So I think they were a better matchup against Tokyo, but Tokyo will be kicking themselves to have not won that game. But against Yokohama and teams like that, they're so open. They've got no cover for anyone. Everyone's out for themselves, it looked like. They were just all rushing to the ball. There was no communication about how to set up a defensive line. And I felt sorry for Nishikawa, because he made a lot of good saves in this game as well to keep the score down, as well as the missed passes from Yokohama. I mean, it's really odd, Urawa. They've not played well at all this season, but they've managed to sneak out results in tighter games against maybe the lesser opponents in the league, and then FC Tokyo last weekend. But when they start to fall apart, it really goes to pot. I mean, even in the Champions League, they got a 0-0 draw with Beijing, and I think the shot count was something like 25-1. It was ridiculous, and they've got to go and play Jeonbuk tomorrow or today in the Asian Champions League. And I mean, if they play anything like they did again on Friday, that could be a cricket score.
Yeah, Jeonbuk, obviously, extremely powerful club from the K League, so that'll be one to watch, as Sam says, on Tuesday night. So a good away win for F Marinos last Friday. Nagoya didn't have things quite as nice when they visited Kashima last Friday. Antlers are in action in the ACL on Tuesday as well, also against South Korean opposition in the form of Gyeongnam. And they warmed up for that game, Antlers, with a come-from-behind 2-1 win over previously top Grampus, who slipped down to third behind Hiroshima and FC Tokyo. Another pretty ordinary defensive display on show at the Kashima Soccer Stadium as well, Sam. Gabriel Xavier's admittedly well-struck goal in the 47th minute was an absolute nightmare, though, for Kwon-Sun Tae, who allowed the ball to go basically straight through his legs and into the net. A trademark classy finish from Sean Madoy saw Antlers equalise, though, with 18 minutes to go. And then what can you say about Leo Silva's winner 10 minutes from time, Sam? Obviously a superb individual goal, but that's the sort of goal that you score when you're playing winning 11 on the easy level. You just stroll past five or six defenders and a slot past the keeper. It would seem to be that easy for Leo Silva.
Yeah, there are plenty of token gestures of challenges in the midfield there. I mean, it's a very good run from Leo Silva, and once he gets up to speed, he can be difficult to stop, but it was very flimsy for him to just wander through the middle of the Nagoya defence. I mean, yeah, defensively, both teams were pretty ordinary. I mean, the goal that Nagoya scored, Kwon-Sun Tae doesn't make many errors, so this was very unlike him to let that sort of effort go past him. So I'll maybe forgive him this one. But there's a lot of defensive issues at Kashima. Like, they were missing from this game Uchida, Jung Seung-hyun and Shuto Yamamoto. So that's arguably three of your main back line there. So it's going to be difficult for them to kind of fully come together and get a cohesive unit together. And then Nagoya, their defense is okay. It's better this season than it has been. But Kazuma's substitutions are a bit too cavalier. When Kashima equalized, he changed one fullback for Yuki Soma. So you played a winger. I think it was a left back. He came on for Yoshida, I think, or maybe it was Miyahara. And then later on, Mateus was the other fullback. So they give no real thought to defending. They just want to go and attack, and that's going to catch them out on plenty of occasions, especially against a team like Kashima, who have the quality that they do in the likes of Leo Silva and Shoma Doi, as you mentioned. But yeah, I thought it was a decent game, but quite competitive. I thought it was fairly even, but Kashima have just kind of got this will to win, and they will pull results out when maybe they're not playing as well as they can do. But yeah, they are a team that you always back to kind of come through in the end, and that's how it was in this game.
Yes, indeed, and a performance like that, as you say, with so many injuries, not only in defence, but yeah, throughout the squad, of course, with Yuma Suzuki still out. I mean, as a Tokyo supporter, you would say, well, it's an ideal time to play them this Sunday. But yeah, as we've just seen, and we've seen other times this season, that yeah, they can pull results out where most other teams just wouldn't have the capability, or would have a too thin a squad to be able to pull out results like this. So there's definitely something in the water up in Ibaraki Prefecture, and Antlers, an excellent home win, and yes, they take a lot of confidence into their third ACL group stage match on Tuesday in South Korea. The other game on Friday ended 1-1, and Kawasaki's, I don't know, sluggish is the right word, but yeah, they've certainly struggled to click into any sort of gear for consecutive games anyway. This season, they were held by Cerezo. Well, I say that, but they, of course, had to come from behind after Yoichiro Kakitani's first goal of the relatively new season in the 22nd minute gave visiting Cerezo Osaka a 1-0 lead. But then Kei Chinen scored his a goal in his second straight game 4 minutes into the second half. A composed finish after Ao Tanaka chested down Akihiro Ienaga's ball in from the right. So Cerezo, a good point away from home, although they will have been disappointed not to take all three after taking the lead, Sam. But once again, we're left to talk about Kawasaki and their struggles to really hit any sort of consistent form so far.
Yeah, that really disappoints me again. I mean, Oniki has had to change it. Well, he's not had to, but he has changed his team around quite a bit. I mean, Shintaro Kurumaya has been dropped for the last two games. Yukobayashi was on the bench. Leandro Damião, like key players you'd expect for this Kawasaki team, especially from last season in Kurumaya and Kobayashi. And to not have them playing, it's a strange decision. I thought, for the most part, Cerezo contained Kawasaki quite easily, and it was only one kind of lapse in concentration that allowed Chinen in late to get his equaliser. It's difficult to really put your finger on what it's going wrong with Kawasaki. I imagine when they brought in Leandro Damião, that's how they worked in pre-season. They thought, we've got to kind of get used to this target man up front that we're going to have to play off. It's different to how they've always played with the likes of Kobayashi up front. It's a lot more dynamic. It's a lot more neat interchange rather than trying to play a ball up to a big man. And that hasn't worked for them. And now they've tried to switch it around. And Chinen's getting his goals, but his overall play is not to the same level as you would have with a Kobayashi in there. So they're really struggling to click going forward. Oshima as well, being out injured. I mean, everyone knows he's made of glass, but he usually only gets injured during international breaks. He's been a mainstay for the last two seasons and like a key part in the way that they build up and how they've gone on and won games in the last two seasons. So I think that sort of chopping and changing, those sorts of absences, it's not really helped. But Kawasaki, even last season, were kind of disappointing during the group stage of the Champions League. They kind of struggled to balance it, the two competitions out, so they might hope just to kind of get through this stage and then move on through the gears as they did last season. But at the moment, the quality doesn't seem to be at the same level as previous seasons. It's going to be quite a worry for Kawasaki.
Yes, indeed. And, of course, the Frontale are also in ACL action this midweek. And I should have sensed a pattern when three of the first three teams we've mentioned are playing as South Korean opponents. Well, so are Kawasaki. They are away at Ulsan in match D3 of the group stage. So, yes, South Korean opponents for all four G1 teams in this midweek. So it'll be very interesting to see how they all get on. And obviously K-League United will be all over previewing these games in much more detail than we can do here. So if you're listening to this and there's still time before the games get going, get yourself over to K-League United and check out all of their various previews of this midweek's action. All right, well, they're the three games from Friday, Sam. So we have four left to cover, and they obviously all took place on Saturday as well. So let's begin with the game that kicked off the proceedings on Saturday at 1 o'clock at the Sapporo Dome. Oita kept the good times rolling, and so did Noriaki Fujimoto. I think he's been diddled out of the second goal here somewhat, Sam. Although, yeah, to be fair, it probably was an own goal off Hiroki Miyazawa. I think the DAZN commentator originally tried to give it to Fujimoto. It did look like it went in off him, but yeah, it probably was an own goal from Miyazawa. But yeah, Fujimoto got his sixth of the season in just the second minute to give Oita a very, very early lead. Great work from Kazuki Kozuka, his cross in from the right. It actually did look like it was going out of play, but Yuji Hoshi pulled it back from the byline, and yeah, Fujimoto lashed in off the underside of the bar, just playing with an unbelievable confidence. Sam, he certainly, you know, in general play, I mean, he's not the most electric player, is he? But he's just hit a purple patch of being in the right time, in the right place at the right time, and he is finishing his chances particularly well, isn't he?
Yeah, he offers very little in open play, really, in the build-up, but he's a dynamo once he gets into the area. He's just too sharp for a lot of defenders, at least he has been to start this season. He's got the goals that his kind of work rate up there has deserved. I've been really impressed with Oita, and unlike a lot of newly promoted teams, they've got a lot of squad depth. I mean, you mentioned Yuji Hoshi there. I think this was his first league start of the season. He was very impressive, and the work rate and the ability to hook that ball in for the first goal was sensational. I would have given it up, definitely, and I think most players would have, but yeah, he did really well. But as well as that, they've got different kind of attacking midfielders. They can play that Adewanayo up front for a front two, but then they've got the likes of Mitsuhira and Kozuka, who started this game. They've played Yusuke Goto, who's played well and got assists. They've got Seigo Kobayashi, who I really liked when he was at Vissel Kobe. He's still to come in. So there are a lot of good options for this team. They play really nice football with Shun Takagi starting everything from the back in goal. Like, they're really, really good to watch, and they caused so many problems for Sapporo early on and really kind of caught them off guard. And with the fragile confidence that Sapporo have got at the moment, it was a perfect way to start and to put Sapporo really up against it early on.
Yeah, I mean, that's it's one of the most puzzling stories of the early part of the season, isn't it, Consadole? I mean, we knew they had a little bit of upheaval in the off-season with Ken Tokara leaving, with Shingo Hyodo leaving. I mean, you know, they're not massive names, but they were important important squad players. I mean, Jay Bothroyd was the first-choice striker, but as we've seen again this season, he can't be relied on to stay fit, and Tokara filled the void, you know, very effectively last season. So while Musashi Suzuki has looked very good in patches, and obviously Anderson Lopez is, you know, from time to time has looked unplayable when he's not jumping into moats, or maybe that's actually what's helped him in that game against Shimizu. Maybe he should be jumping into the moat every single time he plays at Sapporo Dome, I don't know. But, yeah, the fact that they've, once again, I mean, I mentioned it last week and I'll have to mention it again, the fact that they haven't kicked on after that big home win over Shimizu, and it's three straight losses now, and obviously, you know, Misha Petrovic has seen a lot in this league, so I'm sure he won't be pushing too many panic buttons. But at the same time, you know, this is a game that they would have penciled in as a win. I mean, as impressive as Oita have been in the early going, I mean, that's a pretty ordinary result. And even after they got it back to 2-1, thanks to another own goal this time from Yoshinori Suzuki. I mean, with 20 minutes to go, Sapporo, they weren't able to get anything out of the game with that much time left in it. So no panic buttons, but there must be a lot of head-scratching going on up there.
Yeah, I think so. And I think you said it right when with Suzuki and Anderson Lopez. They're very good in patches. I mean, Suzuki got a hat-trick for Nagasaki last season. That came out of nowhere. And then he started this season quite well. But he's not someone that can be relied upon week in, week out. And I think, and the same with Anderson Lopez, really. I think when he played at San Freccia a couple of seasons ago, he was very average to me. And then this season, he's played very well in that Shimizu game, of course, to get four goals. And then he's had other decent performances. But then when he's not on it, he just doesn't really offer anything. And they've lost some big players. And like Bothroyd and Tokara, and Bothroyd to injury and then Tokara, obviously, to Cerezo. As well as kind of giving that focal point to the attack and giving, like, obviously, their goals as well. They've got that experience and they kind of like that leadership that this team seems to be lacking. Tokara especially. I was having this discussion with Alan Gibson on Twitter about kind of Tokara's leadership abilities in the dressing room and how he can kind of G up a team and get them fired up, because they lose confidence quite quickly. And they didn't really show any sort of fight in the second half, even at 2-1. And then Miyoshi is another big loss. I mean, you've seen how well he's played both last season and then Yokohama this season. So that's another key issue. And then the other thing is, last season they performed so far above themselves. They were, like, what, where did they finish? Like 15th or something? 14th or 15th the season before? And then last season they brought in a few players, but it was still essentially the same side. But that team were playing so far above themselves. And last year, like, I heap praise on the likes of Fukumori and Shindo at the back, but they've not started this season well at all. They're so shaky, again, lacking in confidence. And when you need those sorts of players to be playing kind of above themselves, if Sapporo were to challenge in the top four where they did last season. But that hasn't happened, plus the kind of inconsistency going forward. And yeah, they're just a really weird team. Like, if they're not on it, they're terrible.
Yes, indeed. So it'll be very interesting to see how Sapporo get things right in the next couple of weeks. So I said, yeah, that was the first game on Saturday. We'll move on to the game that concluded the match day in the evening kickoff at Matsumoto. Hosts Yamaga upset the form guide by claiming a hugely impressive 2-1 home win over the Kobe Galacticos. So what is it? No Podolski, no party for Vissel Sam. Lucas Podolski, after goals in two straight games, was not involved in the match day squad here. It must be said that the one of the foreigners who came in to replace him as the fifth foreigner in the match day squad, Wellington, came off the bench for his first appearance of the season and came on for David Vija before half time and got Kobe back into the game with his 75th minute header from Kyogo Furuhashi's cross. But similar to Sapporo, Sam, they had plenty of time to at least equalise and then potentially go on and claim all 3 points, Kobe. But Matsumoto deserve a huge credit, and their fanatical home support at the All Wind Stadium will have gone home very, very happy and very, very satisfied after their side had taken a 2-0 lead in the first half and gone on to see the game out. So a very important early season result for Yamaga.
Yeah, a really great result for Matsumoto. They battled really hard. They got a little bit of luck in the game. I mean, the first goal is a horrendous goalkeeping error. And then later in the game, there are a few refereeing decisions that Mr. Mikitani doesn't like and wants VAR for, but that have gone against Vissel Kobe and definitely helped out Matsumoto. But I think you have to give them a lot of credit. They kind of stood up to the Galacticos of Vissel Kobe, got in their faces quite early. And, I mean, with Daizen Maeda, who's possibly one of my favourite players in the league, the kind of dynamo just in behind the striker, who never stops running, put their defence under so much pressure. It was really great to see. And they took their chances. They were dangerous with crosses into the box that Kobe defence and goalkeeper didn't deal with. And yeah, they got a very creditable 3 points. But for Kobe, you said Podolski, no party, but then no David Villa, because he wasn't fit. He shouldn't really have been playing, I don't think. He had that groin injury, suffered against Gamba the week before, and I don't think he was ready. But then as I know Wellington scored, and he played quite well. He does what he does. He gets himself about. He's a target man. He'll score headers. But it's not really the way that Vissel want to play. Like, Iniesta has never had a player at Barcelona where he's just had to chip the ball up to. He's always had, like, dynamic players that will play in the channels and he'll go on to his through passes. But once you take Podolski out and once you take Villa out and put Wellington there, it doesn't really work as well. And kind of, they were reluctant to put crosses in and really play to Wellington's strengths, and it just wasn't the right fit. And I think if they're going to play without Vieira in the future, if this injury has got worse, I think they should be looking at playing a smaller player up front. Just, I think that would work better with the way that Kobe want to play. Despite Wellington playing fairly well and scoring, it's, I think, for the benefit of the team, I don't think Wellington should be starting.
All right, then. So Kobe's momentum halted, as we've discussed. They were fourth at the kickoff and slid three spots to seventh in the table. There was also an end to any momentum for Shonan Belmare, who had risen to fifth in the early going. But, were sucker-punched, I think, to some regard by Jubilo Iwata. But it must be said, huge credit to Iwata for their first win of the season. And tell you what, Sam, why don't we do the last two games together? Because it was also a first victory of the new season for Vegalta Sendai, as they hauled themselves off the foot of the table in, at times, a comical circumstances at home against Tosu. So Iwata won 2-0 at the BMW Stadium over Shonan Belmare, and an own goal from Masahito Onoda in the 72nd minute, and then a Rodriguez goal in the 96th with everybody up, including the keeper Yota Akimoto, for a late Shonan free kick. The set piece was pretty poorly taken straight into the hands of the Jubilo keeper Kaminski, who threw the ball halfway down the pitch, and Rodriguez was the quickest to it, and from 45 yards stroked a finish into the empty net to win it 2-0 for Iwata. So fair play to them. And and Sendai 3-0 at home over Tosu, Sam. Tosu are really, really battling here, and the fact that they're not bottom is an indictment on Espol. Sorry, Barry, but yeah, just one goal from six games for Tosu. Ryo Germain, Shingo Hyoda, who he mentioned, has transferred from Sapporo to Sendai this year. And then Ramon Lopez in the 93rd minute redeemed himself after missing a penalty about 10 minutes earlier, awarded in absolutely comical circumstances, Sam. I mean, that's certainly not a video that the Tosu defender Carlo Brugic will want to see back.
Oh, God, I did. I've watched that over and over again. It was that magnificent. Just, he missed his clearance by so much. Did a 360-degree turn in midair, landed on the ball to concede a penalty. And that wasn't the only thing he did wrong in this game. He was all over the place. I mean, for the second goal, I think he dives in and gets nowhere near it. Plenty of other occasions, he caught out of position, kind of falls over and gets beaten really easily. And I mean, this Tosu team are a mess. I mean, they're missing Torres, and Victor Ibarbo is still somewhere. He's still recovering from a long-term injury. So maybe if they get those two back and they can link with Kanazaki and Cuenca, there might be something positive at Tosu. But at the moment, they can't keep a clean sheet because they're all over the place. And when they go upfield, they've got basically Mu Kanazaki working on his own, pretty much running the channels, doing a lot, like kind of running himself into the ground, but he doesn't take enough chances. He's not clinical. They've only got that one goal for an Isaac Cuenca header, and you're not going to rely on Cuenca headers very often. So there's not a lot of positivity at Tosu. I mean, Sendai didn't have to play too well to win this game 3-0, and Sendai have been dispatched pretty easily by most teams they've come up against this season. So it's a really worrying result for Tosu. Then onto the Shonan Jubilo game. This was I think quite easily the worst game of the weekend. There wasn't much to it. Shonan really disappointed me. I thought they'd play quite well this season, but didn't really create too much. I don't know if they took Jubilo a little bit lightly, given that Jubilo haven't played that well this season, but did get a point against Kashima last weekend. But Jubilo scored through an own goal and a goal with no goalkeeper, so it wasn't the greatest of goals for them, but they'll take the victory and a bit of confidence into the derby at the weekend.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they have been up and down a little bit, haven't they, Sean? And I mentioned earlier that earlier in the season, that in match day two, when I went to watch FC Tokyo play away at the BMW, that, yeah, Shonan were disappointing, and they were unable to build on their opening day at home win over Sapporo. But, obviously, as we know, they're a fairly limited team, Shonan, but on their day, they are capable of some decent results. So yeah, I certainly wasn't expecting them to stick up in fifth all season, don't get me wrong, but I do expect them to finish above Tosu, and that'll be another bet won over Scott McIntyre if that happens to eventuate. But yes, a long way to go in the season, but tell you what, a couple more wins for Shonan. I don't know whether Tosu will be able to catch him, Sam, the way they're struggling at the moment, but we shall see. All right, well, that's all of the games from J1 Match Day 6 wrapped up, and obviously we've got a busy week of ACL action on the cards this midweek. So, Sam, yeah, it's terrific to get you back on the podcast. I'll try and have somebody else, a different, not an FC Tokyo guest, for when you make your next appearance. So we might change it up a bit next time, if that's okay with you.
Oh, sounds good to me.
All right, well, yeah, thanks again for your time, and yes, I'll speak to you again soon.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. Speak to you later.
All right, my thanks again to Sam Robson. I'll be back in a moment with Stuart Smith. Welcome back, and joining us to wrap up a busy week and a bit in J2 is Stuart Smith. Welcome back to the podcast, Stuart. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Ben. Thank you very much for having me on. It's been a busy week in J2, so probably quite a bit to talk about, I think.
Most definitely. So since our last J2 special, all J2 clubs played basically three match days in the space of 8 days. Last weekend, of course, and then a midweek round before match day 8 was played on Sunday. So that will be our focus, but we'll also mention how the clubs in and around the top 6 and the top half of the table got on in those three rounds. So on Sunday, Stuart, Montedio Yamagata roared up to the top of the table. They were fifth at the kickoff on Sunday, but they came from behind to beat Tokyo Verde at home. They left it late with Shuhei Otsuki grabbing the winner right at the death. But Yamagata continuing on their impressive early start.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they haven't lost since the opening game of the season, which seems a long time ago because it was Gifu that beat Montedio on the first day. And yeah, you're right. They left it a bit late. They were 1-0 down at half time, and Tokyo Verde looked actually quite good in this first half. Well worthy of their lead. But Yamagata, they're not a kind of blessed with stars, but they're a very functional unit. And they all know their roles, and they've got some attacking prowess as well. Obviously, you don't get to the top of the league without being able to go on and score goals. I think Jefferson Baiano leads the line well, and they've got some good players behind him as well. And you mentioned Otsuki there. You got Sakamoto as well, who scored in this game as well. And I think that they are functional rather than kind of exciting to watch, but at the moment that seems to be serving them well. I mean, they won on Sunday, and in midweek they went to Kyoto and they won there as well. And I think those two good results back to back propelled them to the top of the table, and they're in a great run of form, and we'll see if they can continue it. I think a shout out to John Steele. I said I wasn't going to give him a shout out, but he did predict that Montedio Yamagata would be one of the teams to watch. So, so far they're coming through for him.
All right. Well, yeah, very early days, Stuart. So you don't want to get too carried away with giving a John Steele credit, but yes, he's got that right so far. So, yes, well done, John. And I did want to give Yamagata props, obviously, for going top of the league, Stuart. But yeah, rather than talk about the teams that that started the match day in first and second and were shunted down a spot each in the table after Yamagata's win, I want to move next on to the much ballyhooed battle of FC Ryukyu and Kashiwa Reysol. Obviously, at the time of our J2 special, they were the top two in the division. Over the course of the previous two match days, they had slipped a little with Ryukyu losing their first game of the season in the process. And so when this game kicked off down in Okinawa, it was the late game on Sunday. It was fourth hosting third, but still, yeah, a huge occasion. And Ryukyu doing well again on the crowd front. Good to see a crowd of over 7,500, which was Jeff Osborne's benchmark in his last appearance on the podcast. He said that he would like to see crowds up and around that number, and obviously Kashiwa's support have got around the country very effectively. Early doors, there was that huge crowd early on in Niigata, wasn't there, Stuart? So, yeah, did this game live up to the billing? It finished 1-1, as we'll come on to, as did the results for the top two at kickoff. But, yeah, there was a lot of hype, at least on this podcast, for this game before it started. And, yeah, how was it as a spectacle?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of hype, but I mean, if you're looking at this game as a neutral, then they should have been hyped. The two of the better teams so far in this league. Obviously, Kashiwa are the big name in the league. They've got the big name players and the well-known national team players and whatnot. And FC Ryukyu have done really well this year so far. I think that Ryukyu will be probably happier with this point, even though they're at home. I think from the highlights I saw, I haven't watched the full game, but from the highlights that I saw, Reysol looked like they were on top for a lot of the game, and they got an early goal, which, you know, it can be a real kind of balloon pop to a team that thrives on confidence such as Ryukyu. But you know, Gabriel scored after, I think it was 5 minutes or so, I can't remember exactly, but after that, Reysol were on top for much of the game, but they didn't add to their lead. And then, yeah, if you're just winning by the odd goal, you in J2, you're always susceptible to being pegged back. And I think Ryukyu equalised with about 5 minutes to go. And it shows that despite their kind of previous defeat, that they couldn't have had a much tougher game to bounce back with than Reysol, but they went behind, but they fronted up and they stayed the course and they got their rewards at the end. And so probably Reysol will feel that they could/should have won. But I think we've seen enough from Ryukyu so far this year to know that going down to Okinawa is, if you'll pardon the easy joke, it's not going to be a holiday down there, because they're a good side, they work hard, and they've got a goal threat as well. And with kind of Koji Suzuki and Tommy Dokuro as well, they're always likely to create chances. And, you know, with especially Suzuki in the form that he's in, he's going to take some. And if I was Jeff Osborne, I'd be very, very, very happy with how Ryukyu are doing right now. And, yeah, long may it continue for them.
Yeah, absolutely terrific. I mean, yeah, you mentioned Koji Suzuki and Tommy Dokuro, two of the important attacking players. Well, yeah, Sato Kiweijo is quickly making himself another. He's come off the bench here to net again. And, yes, an equaliser inside the last 10 minutes to rescue a point for the hosts. And yes, if we can reset somewhat on Ryukyu, it's been an absolutely phenomenal start to the season. Yeah, 15 points from 8 games. That the one loss that I referenced briefly was to Chiba away in match day 7, so that will have been a frustrating evening for Ryukyu supporters. But I mean, they had to know that they weren't going to go the entire season unbeaten. So to get back on track against the powerhouse of J2, as you mentioned, Stuart, in Kashiwa, it will have been fantastic. And yes, they find themselves the top scorers in the league after 8 games. So 15 points and 15 goals from 8 games is a spectacular return. And if the number that Jeff Osborne and myself are settled on of around 42, 43 points is going to be needed for safety, well, they're more than a third of the way there, 8 games into the season. And, they obviously made a spectacular start. And as you say, Stuart, long may it continue. So let's go back up the table slightly, Stuart, and talk about Kofu and Mito. They began the match day as the top two in J2, and both in similar circumstances to Ryukyu and Kashiwa, both slipped a spot in the match day after 1-1 draws. Kofu headed to Machida, and Mito hosted Tokushima. So, we know that this J2 table is going to be bunched up this season, Stuart. There doesn't look to be, unless Kashiwa really get their act in gear, it doesn't look like there's going to be a team running away with it. So I don't think we need to worry too much about this being a missed opportunity for Kofu or for Mito, who obviously, like Ryukyu, have got a bit of a nosebleed being up this high early in the season. But, obviously Kofu, they're after struggling in match day 1 against Omiya, they've clicked into gear somewhat, and Kofu and Mito still the two unbeaten sides after 8 rounds.
Yeah, I think that Kofu, it's not a missed opportunity. I think Machida have had their wobbles, but they're still a decent outfit. They've still got some really good players, and Kofu were, I think they were 1-0 down at the break, and they conceded just before half time. But you look at the kind of resources that Kofu can call upon. I mean, they started the game with Dudu on the bench, and Dudu had scored twice in midweek when they beat Gifu. They started with Koichi Sato, who's also in goal scoring form, on the bench as well. So when they need to change something, or when they need an extra spark, they have it available. And I think that's going to prove very beneficial for them as the season wears on, because obviously we all know it's a long hard slog in J2. You pick up injuries, you get tired, you have these weeks where you have 3 games, and the ability to rotate and change, especially up front, to keep players fresh is going to be vital for whoever wants to stay up near the top. With Mito, I mean, Mito do this often. They often have a really good start and they kind of fall away. This time it's going on a bit longer, and they would be top if Jordi Boyce, I think I pronounced that right, Jordi Boyce hadn't equalized in the last minute of additional time, because that's what happened for Vortis. They were 1-0 down going into additional time, and I think a cross came in and Boyce got on the end of it to take a 1-1 draw. And if Mito could have held on just for that extra minute, they would be on the top of the pile at the minute. And it's Mito, the team that kind of people should be looking at, I'm not expressing myself very well, but teams like Kanazawa, like Gifu, like Tochigi, even the ones in J3, like Gunma, like those kind of teams, you can play good football and you can get to the upper reaches of the league if you have a set system and a belief and that all the players can buy into. Because I think it is more about the system, because you look at the players they lost in the winter. They lost Jefferson Baiano to Yamagata. They lost Kishimoto, who went to Tokushima Vortis and started against them on Sunday. But new players have just come in. They've stepped in. They've got a good manager. Everyone seems to know what they're doing. And, yeah, and another one, long may it continue, because, yeah, it's good to have the smaller teams, I say smaller teams, but the lesser known teams battling at the top, and it's really good to see.
Yeah, terrific stuff. So yeah, Mito unbeaten, as we've said, I mean, 9 goals from 8 games, it doesn't look all that impressive, but when you consider that Kashua Reysol have the exact same goals for column, well then yes, they're not travelling too bad at all, and up in third on merit. So yeah, that's our look at the top five, with as we've kind of mentioned throughout, Yamagata roaring up from fifth to first, and the previous incumbents in first through fourth all sliding down a spot in the table after playing out 1-1 draws. So Kanazawa round out the top six, Stuart, and Omiya are hot on their heels after both won in match day 8. Kanazawa 1-0 at home over Chiba, and Omiya returned from bottom club Kagoshima with a 2-0 victory. So anything to see here with either of those two? Is Omiya, they'll be happy to be this high up in the table, I think, Stuart. And it gives them a decent platform. Obviously, just 3 points off top spot with it being so bunched up early doors. So obviously, yeah, feel free to reference Kanazawa if you like. But I mean, yeah, Omiya are obviously a big name in this league. And they were slow to get going, but they're rounding into form quite nicely, it seems.
Yeah, they are. 3 wins in a week. This has been a really good week for Takagi and Omi. Of course, they went to Nagasaki last weekend and came back with the points, and a win against Okayama and a win down at Kagoshima as well, make it 9 points in 3 games. Suddenly, it's all looking a lot rosier. They seem to be... they seem to be finding out who they are, and they seem to be kind of settling into the system. I think maybe it was a little bit of a shock to the system to have a three at the back, maybe, because that's how Takagi plays. And maybe it was a shock to have a one top, two shadow, as they like to say in footballing parlance. I think Robin Simovic played up front on Sunday, but he's been interchangeable with Juanma, and they give a big physical presence, which in turn, I think, it makes Genki Omae less productive in front of goal, but it gives him a lot more freedom to work with in a more kind of creative capacity. So maybe it's just been a case of people getting used to certain systems and getting used to a new manager coming in. And they picked up 9 points in the last week, and it's going to make a huge change, especially this earlier on in the season, to your prospects. And the same for Kanazawa, really. Kanazawa, when they won three in a row, they haven't conceded. They beat Yokohama last week, Kagoshima, Chiba. I think they're doing incredibly well to be up there. Whether they have the squad and whether they have the resources like Omi or Corfu do, I doubt it. However, they're up there on merit right now. They're playing some good stuff. They're defensively very, very sound. And that'll get you quite far in this league, actually. And it's good to see Kanazawa going up there.
All right then, so the last couple of games that I wanted to mention from Sunday before we wrap up the three match days as a whole, Stuart, were the other two victories. Kyoto won 2-1 at Tochigi to move up from 11th to 8th, and then the big mover in the match day, even rising up more spots than new leaders Yamagata was, of course, and you won't want to hear this, but Ehime FC moved up from 19th to 13th with their 2-0 home win over FC Gifu. And Well, yeah, we've spoken in the early going about how Mito are often fast starters but then fade away, Stuart. Well, that has been the case for Gifu a couple of times in recent seasons as well, where early season optimism gives way to the harsh realities. I mean, you're on 8 points after eight games, and there are a bunch of teams on the same number. I mean, you're 3 points away from ninth place Niigata, so we're not consigning Gifu to J3 or anything like that. But there was optimism early doors, but that's I don't know. You can tell me if it's faded or not after the last few results.
Yes, it has.
Okay, right.
To preface this, I mean, like you said there, I mean, they're 3 points off Niigata in 11th. And so right now, it's not an emergency situation, right? It's like Gifu's next two games are at home. They got Nagasaki and they got Mito. Two wins there, and suddenly everything looks a lot nicer.
Sure.
And everything looks a lot more positive. But on the flip side, two defeats, and it starts to kind of, by that point, I think by the end of April, a gap will have started to form. You know, like how there's always kind of the kind of gap in the middle where the playoff teams separate from the teams battling against relegation. I think that'll form sooner rather than later, and I think that it's really important that Gifu kind of get back on the horse as soon as possible. The home and away splits are very stark. I mean, Gifu, they haven't scored a goal away from home in their four games this year. They've lost all four, but at home they've won two and drawn two. So I mean, I suppose it's good that the next two games are at home, but I mean, if that continues, I mean, you can't realistically expect to keep winning or staying undefeated at home whilst losing on the road. It doesn't happen that way. So I think that something has to kind of change, and I think something has to get kick-started sooner rather than later before this kind of... Because I expect, in particular, I expect Renofa, Yamaguchi and Nagasaki not to be down there for any length of time. And so once you take those two out of the equation, it starts to become, quote-unquote, the usual suspects, because Tochigi will still be down there. I think Ehime will probably end up down there at some point. But, you know, it's not kind of panic stations just yet, but Gifu are now five without a win and haven't scored in four of those games. And so, you know, you look at it and you think, right, something has to change. We just touched on Tochigi there. I mean, they were beaten by Kyoto, like you said. I mean, they shot themselves in the foot. The first goal they conceded was a really bad defensive mistake. And they had enough chances to take something out of this game, but Kyoto will feel very kind of happy that they got a... I think they got a little bit out of jail against Tochigi, but it's all about the results, really, and Kyoto sit there in eighth, and Tochigi sit down in 18th, so it's a game of fine margins, really.
Yes, indeed. All right. Well, there was one other thing I wanted to mention from match day eight, and that's the fact that I think Yokohama FC might have set some sort of record. Stuart, obviously, they do any time Kazuyoshi Miura starts, but he's a strike partner at the start of Sunday's home game against Fukuoka, and the game ended a 1-1. Was Koki Saito, who I believe is 17 years old, and there is what is it? Is it 35 years or something? 45 years between them or something? There must be some sort of record between the age difference between strike partners or something like that.
Well, yeah, I think Sean Carroll mentioned it on Twitter. He said that, I think he said something like 17-year-old Koki Saito starts for Yokohama yet Yokohama's combined age strike force is 69 years old or something like that. Yeah. I think it's the first time they started together, but I'm pretty sure they've played together. I'm almost certain they played together last year, because I remember thinking there can't possibly be a strike force that has such an age gap. I mean, it's ridiculous to think about. Last year, of course, last year Saito was 16. But like, he was a 16-year-old. He came off the bench to partner Kazu, and I thought this is borderline unbelievable, having a 16-year-old and a 51-year-old playing together up front. But it's odd. It's a little bit odd that Kazu is starting as much as he is. Because he started against Gifu and came off after about 50 minutes or an hour, and Iba came on to replace him and promptly scored and set one up. He did the same again against Fukuoka. Like, obviously Kazu started, Iba came on to replace him, and Iba came on and scored a penalty as well. And so I wonder, it's a little bit odd, because it's odd having Iba on the bench instead of on the field, where unless Tavares is trying to keep him fresh for the summer, I don't know, or if he's trying to kind of get people into the Mitsuzawa to see Kazu, I'm not sure, but it's kind of an odd tactic, in my opinion.
I think it might be a lot to do with trying to get people into Mitsuzawa to see Kazu. But yeah, I tell you what, if you can't, if that doesn't motivate Iba, I mean, not getting a start ahead of a 52-year-old, then I don't know what it does. Well, obviously it's worked, because, as you say, the last two times that Kazu started, he's come off, Iba's come on and scored. So, the whatever motivation Tavares has behind it, it seems to be working. So, fair dues. And, you've got to try things to get people through the gates in J2. We know that that Kazu, he's obviously still physically able to do it. And, in these two starts, he's played more minutes combined than he did the entirety of the 2018 season. So there is still a bit of life left in the old legs. And if he does happen to fluke a goal and we see the Kazu dance again, then he's sure to hit the headlines all over the world again. And the marketing guys at the J-League will eat up all that coverage, I'm sure. So, that's where we'll leave J2. Stuart, just a brief mention for J3, shall we, after they played a match day 5 over the weekend?
Why not? Let's have a brief mention. Because I think for people that don't follow J3, there's quite a big story there. Because Giravance Kitakyushu, I know they drew 1-1 at the weekend away at Katari Toyama, but they're at the top now, and they were, I think I'm right in saying, they were rock bottom last year, possibly below all these under 23 sides, and this is kind of quite the turnaround this year. They're not the most exciting side, but they've only conceded 2 goals thus far, which, you know, if your defense is that tight, then you're always going to be in with a chance of winning games. And it's good to see them. It's good to see them back. I want to say where they belong, but I think, you know, it, just to have them back on the map, really, because, you know, you go back 3 or 4 years and they were, you know, the next big thing. You know, they had that wicked stadium in the pipeline. They just finished 5th, but they couldn't participate in the playoffs, and then it all kind of sank like a stone. But it's good to see them back up in the upper reaches of J3, and, you know, hopefully they're primed for a promotion push, because it'd be good to see that stadium in J2.
That's absolutely phenomenal, Stuart. I didn't prep you at all about the possibility of a J3 section, and you've just gone to town on Kitakyushu. That's absolutely terrific. They are one of two unbeatens left in J3 after 5 match days. The other is Kamatamare Sanuki, previously of J2. Of course, they joined Kitakyushu on 13 points after a 2-1 home win over Fukushima. So they're unbeaten. There are two teams yet to win after five rounds, Stuart. They are Nagano, previously, of course, a J3, well, I was going to say powerhouse, if there is such a thing. They were perennial promotion contenders anyway. But, yes, they find themselves third from bottom after five rounds, and they lost it 2-1 at home to Iwate in match day five. And, yeah, the FC Tokyo under-23s prop up the table with nil pois from five games after a 2-1 loss at Gunma Osaka under-23. So an under-23 derby that was, they're always a keenly fought, of course. So, yes, a stain on the good name of FC Tokyo, this under-23 thing. I absolutely detest it. But anyway, that's, yeah, that's for another podcast. One other thing, Stuart, is obviously the new boys in town, Vanrore Hachinohe. They're seventh after five games. So they drew 2-2 at home against Tottori in match day five. And they're the joint top scorers in the league after five games. So they seem to have settled into life in the J-League and in J3 relatively comfortably.
Yeah, they have. A while ago, we talked about Ryukyu and Kagoshima to a certain extent, although they've gone down the table a little bit. But to come into the league with confidence and with momentum is a useful thing to have. And I think Hachinohe have continued their kind of positive ways, shall we say. They're not shy in front of goal. They're a little bit haphazard at the back, but it's J3. I mean, I'm not sure that we're going to expect kind of rock solid defending all the time. One thing I would say is that I thought maybe Hachinohe might get a few more people into their stadium. I think they played at home this last weekend, and they attracted, I think it says here, just under 1,400, which I'd have to check how much their stadium holds, because it is a little kind of, what's the word I'm looking for, a quaint new stadium. Right. It's pretty, I'm not sure how many it would hold, to be perfectly honest. But they got over 2,000 in their first game, and then it's down to 1,300. I'm not sure what the weather was like up there. It might have been really cold, or I'm not sure. But I thought, Hachinohe, people might get out a little bit more in force. But maybe, you know, maybe once word gets out that goals are going to come and you're guaranteed to see entertaining football, then hopefully the public up there might get behind their team a bit more.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, it's good to see them, making the most of their early adventures in J3. And, yeah, you would hope the people of Hachinohe and, yes, Aomori Prefecture would be getting behind the team in stronger numbers. But, yes, maybe when the weather gets a bit better up there, then the numbers will be a bit healthier. So, yeah, five games in the new J3 season, obviously, is the table is fairly bunched up in places, with the exception of the FC Tokyo under-23s, of course. But, yeah, early doors there, and a lot to be decided in the next few months. One thing that the J-League certainly wouldn't want to consider at this stage, Stuart, but they're going to have a contingency plan for, is the fact that the Cerezo Osaka under-23s are third and Gunma under-23s are sixth. And, I mean, if they were to finish in the top two places, I mean, that would just be, you wouldn't bear to think about how embarrassing that would be for the rest of the league. And, I mean, do you know if there's any, obviously they can't get promoted, but would there be any allowance for teams that finish below them to get promoted? Or it probably strictly has to be the top two, doesn't it? There probably wouldn't be anyone going down from J2 at that rate.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, the under-23 teams have been so bad in previous seasons, I haven't really thought about it. But my gut feeling is that if, say, Cerezo and Gamba under-23s finish 1 and 2 in the league, then I would think that there would be no relegation.
Yeah.
I'm not 100% certain of that, but going from what's happened in the past, then I would expect, just Gamba and Cerezo under 23s to completely screw over the rest of the J3. I wouldn't expect them. Say, for example, if Kitakyushu finished third, I wouldn't expect them just to be promoted on the back of the other two teams being ineligible. Someone will check that, but I'm pretty sure that's how it will run, I think.
Yeah. So, well, obviously we all hope that doesn't eventuate, and the J League most definitely at the top of the list of people who hope that is not the case. All right. Well, we don't want to end on a sour note, Stuart, but yes, that's a J2 and a J3 wrapped up for the time being. Absolutely terrific to get your thoughts on the second tier season after 8 games. And before we know it, it'll be time for another J2 special. So I look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Yeah, I look forward to it. Hopefully I'll be in a slightly more positive mood with Gifu. I'm sure we'll have a lot to talk about next time as well.
All right, then. Well, that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. My thanks again to Sam Robson, Dan Orlowitz, and Stuart Smith, and, of course, to you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to round up another big weekend in the J-League. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk podcast.